Welcome, I'm Terry Christensen, and this is Valley Politics. Today, we'll talk with Danny Harris, who's the program director for the Knight Foundation here in San Jose. In case you haven't heard, the foundation is funding a bunch of pretty interesting projects in our community. We'll learn what the foundation is all about and what they're trying to achieve here, and we'll hear Danny's perspective as a relative newcomer to our community. Later, Tamara Alvarado will brief us on the School for Arts and Culture at the Mexican Heritage Plaza, which happens to be a beneficiary of a grant from the Knight Foundation. Then we'll close our show talking with former San Jose City Councilman Frank Fiscalini, a longtime mover and shaker here in the Valley. All this next on Valley Politics. Welcome, everyone, and welcome, Danny Harris. So tell us, Danny, what's the Knight Foundation about and what's it doing in San Jose?
The Knight Foundation works in the 26 cities where the Knight brothers had newspapers. Obviously, San Jose is one of them. Mm-hmm. And we work in...
They own the Mercury News.
They own the Mercury News, correct. That was a Knight Ritter paper. And so our work in communities is focused in a number of areas. We invest in arts, we invest in journalism, media innovation, and my specific focus is on what we call community and national initiatives. So the short way of thinking about it is we make investments in things that support how San Jose will attract and retain talent, how we understand and support economic opportunity. And the last piece is around civic engagement. You know, the thing that we ultimately measure with our projects is this moving people towards being more informed and engaged, and specifically, you know, are more people voting because of our projects and what we're doing?
So you give away money?
Yes, yeah. I give away someone else's money.
You give away some, so I'm sure a lot of our viewers would like to know, how do you get a job like this?
My path is not linear. So mm-hmm. My background was in international development. I did refugee work. Then I went to go work and look at how terrorists raise and move money. I left that to go work as a storyteller and started a design agency. And my focus there was actually looking at how cities brand themselves in a really crowded marketplace now, with about 66% of millennials choosing a city before a job. It means that the competitive marketplace for places is much more competitive. So I was doing that work and had this amazing opportunity to come and work with Knight, which had always been a place that I'd wanted to work. And I've been here for a little bit over a year now.
That's a very interesting career path. So you've been here for a little over a year. You've lived in some pretty sophisticated cities back east. I just have to ask you, what's your impression of San Jose as a community? Does it kind of seem like a suburban Mayberry to you?
Maybe it's an urban Mayberry.
An urban Mayberry, okay.
You know, coming out here, I think the city has a number of different identities. There's the Valley of Heart's Delight, there's Silicon mm-hmm. Valley, there's the capital of Silicon Valley. And then as you get into the neighborhoods, you may go to Willow Glen, and people would define themselves as being from Willow Glen as opposed to San Jose. So I think that the city is sophisticated. I think you said I come from sort of sophisticated East Coast cities of being raised in New York and living in DC. And I've been amazed at coming here of how many vibrant neighborhoods there are, a great sense of opportunity in this city. And the more time I spend getting to know the communities, the more inspired I am by the opportunities that are here.
We do have a little inferiority complex, as you could tell from that question.
That's true. You know, I like to define what I do as being a philanthropist, where, you know, when I come here, I realize that a lot of the work that we do, whether we're inside the city or coming from outside, is, you know, others won't love San Jose until we love ourselves. So I recognize that there's an inferiority complex. And I think, you know, when we truly have the self-confidence to be a world-class city, that will help us to really see and understand our potential.
All good. Give us some examples of some specific projects that the Knight Foundation has been funding.
Well, just this morning, I was doing the last walkthrough in Plaza Cesar Chavez, right in downtown. Yeah. We brought in, with Adobe and the city, we brought in a landscape architecture firm out of Philadelphia called Groundswell to reimagine the park. And we used the Super Bowl as a catalyst for this change. But for those of you who've been to the park, it's a beautiful space, but it's not as activated as it could be. So our assumptions were, you know, if we put fire pits and music and a beer hall and food, would more people come and linger and see it as a vibrant place to spend time? And with Knight, you'll see that we invest in prototype and new experiments. So whether it's Plaza Cesar Chavez or Viva Calles, where we helped the city shut down 6 miles from cars so that the streets could be open for pedestrians and people on bikes, to longer infrastructure projects. So we're looking at everything from wayfinding in the city to issues of affordable housing, transportation, and even the brand of the city. So our work, in the last year we put out about 70 grants that range from 1 million to 1.7 million. And so it creates an interesting opportunity where we can work with individuals, institutions, and you know, help make it easier for civic innovators to do their work and make a more vibrant city.
Are you funding projects that also relate to issues of inequality in the Valley?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, our focus here is specifically to San Jose. Mm-hmm. So we look a lot at that question of the digital divide and the growing gap between, maybe it's easiest to say between Silicon Valley and the Valley of Heart's Delight, and look at places like Mayfair on the east side, where most of the, or much of the interaction that community there may have with tech is maybe through their children who have smartphones, or maybe they're actually working in the service industry in a tech firm. So I think our hope is to try to bridge that divide by bringing more opportunities to underserved communities as well.
And the broad goals, community building, civic engagement?
I think the broad goals is that we have a vast network of partnerships. I like to say that, you know, the legacy that I hope to leave here and that Knight hopes to leave here is that, you know, when I first moved here, I met with thousands of people just walking neighborhoods, and a few people told me, and I don't know if this is true or not, but for the sake of two friends having a conversation, someone said, you know, there are 400 movers and shakers in San Jose, that if you take this entire city of roughly a million, there's roughly 400 people who make decisions.
I always say it's a village.
It's a village. So if we, for the sake of this conversation, assume there are 400, you know, I'm hell-bent on getting us to 4,000 or 40,000. How do we inspire more people to feel that they can come and make meaningful change in this community? So when we look at the metrics, there's the one around the city and how that will change. We look at partnerships, but really we look at who the new emerging leaders are. And in a place that, you know, has both millennials and baby boomers who are moving downtown and feeling more engaged, you know, you can be an emerging leader at 50, at 60, at 70. You know, people are still working.
Or at 20.
And so understanding the demographics of the city, how do we empower more people to get involved and feel like there's not only a place for them, but there's a pathway towards leadership and success?
It is a village, but the great thing about this village is there are no walls. So you can become a player, you can become a participant quite easily, as you have, although it helps if you've got money.
It does. I think, you know, I think there's an element of money, but there's also the humility to be new to a community and spend time listening. And most of the first year was talking to people and trying to get a sense of, you know, what do you need? What do you feel is missing from the community? And on the positive side, where do you see the opportunities that we can support? So with all of our grants and all of our work, it's never us imposing a set of ideas or a solution, but helping to either challenge people's assumptions. You know, I think in the end of the day, it's not the answers that are most important, but the questions that people are asking. So if we can sit and work with people on those questions, we can help to determine with them what are some pathways that we can take. Because at the end of the day, you know, we're not an implementing foundation. We have the easy job of writing a check and then letting someone else go off and do the work. And so it means that we can follow a whole set of ideas and grants throughout the way, but all of them are driven by the community and they're focused about partnerships.
I know you and the Knight Foundation have focused particularly on millennials, people now in their 20s or 30s, born in the 80s and 90s. Why is that generation so important to the future of this city or any city?
I think there are a few pieces. One, as I mentioned before, you know, two-thirds of millennials are making a decision about a city before a job. So it means that as
about where they want to live,
where they want to live,
before what they want to do.
Exactly. Hmm. So, you know, it means that the competitive marketplace, not only between New York and San Francisco, but between Oakland and Berkeley, or Oakland and San Francisco, or San Jose and Santa Clara, becomes more competitive over time. And what we see with millennials is they're seeking, you know, they're seeking walkable. They want to be around beautiful things. They want to have a set of assets that are close to them as it relates to urban life. But at the same time, they're increasingly seeking purpose and meaning in the kind of jobs that they do. So when we look at these various trends about millennials, and from our perspective also of looking at things like voting rates, you know, when we look at the way that our grandparents voted as opposed to their grandchildren, the voting rates are incredibly different.
Yeah.
And you know, when we think about the future of an informed and engaged society, if a millennial can open up social media and in the end they're almost content agnostic, because whether it's the New York Times or BuzzFeed or somebody who only posts cat videos, they're streaming it through sort of one single source. So it's less important where that information comes from. So we're seeing that, you know, there's an issue around how they make decisions of where to live, how they end up getting their content and inform their opinions, and then how they take action on that. So whether it's volunteerism or voting, you know, we want to look at this entire spectrum and say, you know, what are the opportunities that a city can provide in that space? And especially when we look at the pathways into leadership or opportunity, I think San Jose is an incredible opportunity, one of being a space where as a millennial you can come and be and build something great here in a way that maybe you can't do in San Francisco or Oakland, but also that it's a place that has gaps in leadership and you really can come and be and build something fantastic here.
I wonder if it's a good investment to try to compete with San Francisco for millennials. What if we wait 5 or 10 years, they start to have families, and then inevitably they're going to want to live more in places like San Jose than San Francisco. So what's the rush?
Well, I mean, I agree with you. I think if we look at it in a sort of pound for pound fight, we're not at the same tier. I agree that maybe we can't compete with San Francisco at this moment. But I think that you're exactly right in terms of looking at, you know, what are some of the other opportunities? Because again, I go back to, maybe it's not the answers, but the questions. If a vast majority of the employees of Google and Facebook and Apple live within a proximity that's in the South Bay, mm-hmm. you know, is there an opportunity to target those who are spending 2 to 4 hours a day on a bus and providing them with another urban option that's in the South Bay? So it's wonderful to live in the Mission, but you know, it's great maybe after 9 p.m. on a Tuesday and on the weekend, but if you're spending 4 hours a day commuting, it's a pretty tough challenge. So I think one, there's that element. Two, you're exactly right in terms of when these people choose to have kids and not dogs as they're making that decision in San Francisco.
Yeah,
this is a wonderful place to be. And then the third group is, you know, baby boomers. If you look at the population of baby boomers here, especially as it compares to other cities, we're at a much higher percentage, and baby boomers and millennials are the two fastest groups moving back to cities.
Well, and I have to say, if we make it a good place for millennials to live, it'll be a good place for all of us to live. So it's all good.
Yeah.
Danny Harris, Knight Foundation, thanks for your time today.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Now let's take a look at community news with Tamara Alvarado of the School for Arts and Culture at Mexican Heritage Plaza.
Hi, my name is Tamara Alvarado. I'm the Executive Director of the School of Arts and Culture at the Mexican Heritage Plaza on the east side of San Jose. Our mission is to provide high-quality arts education to the children of East San Jose, activate the Mexican Heritage Plaza as a vibrant cultural venue, and support the development of the next generation of multicultural leaders in Silicon Valley. Since our inception over 4 years ago, and with the support of the community, we have grown from 21 students to over 2,000 served last year, and from 24,000 people coming through our doors to over 60,000 people coming on an annual basis. Our key programs and offerings are the following. In arts education, we offer classes after school and summer day camps throughout the summer. We also have a wonderful program called the Multicultural Arts Leadership Institute. This is a program for people of color who are deeply engaged in arts, culture, and entertainment, and are also interested in giving back to the community. That is a year-long commitment. Our community engagement program now has grown from 3 to 72 content partners, primarily focused on the arts. We also have unique festivals and events such as La Última Parada and Fiesta Navideña. La Última Parada is focused on the Day of the Dead season, and the Fiesta Navideña is focused on all of the learnings and teachings that our children have had throughout the year. If you're also interested in hosting a special event, a private event, or a cultural event, please also contact us. We are located at 1700 Alum Rock Avenue in the heart of the Mayfair neighborhood in our beautiful East Side San Jose. Our website is www.schoolofartsandculture.org. Altogether, schoolofartsandculture.org, and our phone number is 408-794-6250. Thank you so much. I hope to see you very soon at the School of Arts and Culture at the Mexican Heritage Plaza.
Next on Where Are They Now, we'll talk with Frank Fiscalini, who's been a leader in this community since the 1950s and who served on the San Jose City Council from 1993 to 2000. So Frank Fiscalini, longtime superintendent of schools, hospital executive, community leader for many good causes, candidate for mayor, San Jose City Council for two terms. What have you been doing since you retired from all that?
Well, it's kind of interesting, Terry. When I retired from the council, I was approached by one of my former students at James Lick High School, Ed Alvarez. And Ed at that time had formed a company here, Silicon Valley Advisors. It was a group that was involved in doing land use lobbying and research. And he asked me if I would be interested in joining them. And I couldn't say no. He was student body president, by the way, when I was principal at James Lick High School. So
this is the 1950s.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. We had a long association. And I spent about 5 years there. And then my wife became ill. So I spent about the next 6 years taking care of her. Mm. And when she passed, I decided that I really couldn't stay inactive. So I started to do volunteer work again. I went back on the board of Opera San Jose.
Opera San Jose, that's yes. A great, great one.
It is. Yeah. And I was with Irene when we started the company and, you know, been through all the growth pains with it.
Right.
And see it where it is today and appreciate how far we've come. It's a real thrill. I miss Irene terribly because we were really dear friends. And then I serve on Silicon Valley Faces, which is the successor to the old National Conference of Christians and Jews.
Oh,
and
right.
We have some very, very fine educational programs that we do there. And I'm really delighted with the results and continue to spend time and some treasure there, which I think is important. I'm on a committee at the History San Jose Museum. I enjoy that because I'm a history buff by trade, really. And I serve on a board of Child Development Inc., which is a company that operates child care centers.
Okay, so you're not retired at all. You're just not paid.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
Well, yeah. those are all really, really good, really good causes. Yeah. I want to go back to the 60s. With you. You became a superintendent of Eastside Union High School District, a huge district, at a very young age, and served for a very long time, 1956 to 1982, I think.
Yes.
Which is extraordinary. Superintendents don't do that anymore.
No.
But there was a blip in your service when the Board of Trustees fired you.
Yep.
So tell us what happened next.
Well, there was a blip, and it was kind of interesting because I had a four-year contract at the time, and I think the board had a dilemma on its hands. They didn't know whether they were going to have to pay me off, whether I would do something else with respect to the action. So they put me on leave and paid me. The nice part about all of that experience, at least for me, is that the teachers rose up in my defense.
Mm.
Community rose up in my defense. The leadership of the Teachers Association and members of the CUNY came together, formed a committee, filed for recall, ultimately recalled several of the board members that were involved in my termination. And a few months later, I was back on the job. And it was, in many respects, Terry, a very perplexing time for me because I could not understand what happened, why. To this day, I really don't understand why. Quite honestly, until you raised the question with me, I hadn't really thought much about it. I just considered it, quite honestly, part of my growth experience. And I think it was a good one because you learn a lot of things. And I think it ultimately made me a better superintendent.
Well, it also gave you a reputation as somebody with considerable power. in San Jose. And I know in the 70s when I came to town, people were thinking of you as the godfather of East Side politics, because you advised candidates and encouraged people to run. Was that a fair assessment? Were you the godfather of East Side politics?
I don't know whether I was the godfather or not, but I've heard that appellation before.
Yeah.
And but I did get involved. I believe that the leader in this case of a school district had an obligation to be representative of the people that he worked for. We were growing very rapidly in those days,
yeah,
as you'll recall. So it was just a constant process of building schools, hiring teachers, developing curriculum, improving programs, all of the things that you become involved with. And as a result of that, I became involved in external affairs much more really than I would think the normal superintendent would have had done in those days, and maybe even today. I spent a great deal of time in Sacramento lobbying on behalf of the district, seeking more funds for construction purposes, particularly because of the growth. I did a lot of lobbying the city of San Jose, particularly in the arena of low-cost housing. I can remember times
when... We need you to do some more work on that.
Yes. Well, you're probably right. But I spent countless hours trying to convince the council not to place all the low-cost housing in East San Jose.
Yeah, which they did.
That they would rue the day that they did that, and that's come to pass.
Yes.
And my lobbying was for naught, but my intent was, I think, noble and purposeful. It's still true today, Terry.
Yeah.
And until we can provide the appropriate assimilation, we're going to continue to have the kinds of issues that face us.
Did you also encourage candidates, people to run for office?
Who are particularly for school board.
Oh, for school board, yeah.
Again, there was a time when I probably was a little more bold than I might be today in encouraging people. I was particularly concerned because of our growing minority population in the district that we needed minority board members. And I was successful in securing Richard Tanaka to serve. He served for a long period of time on the board. Ed Alvarez served on the board, Jose Martinez, Yaya Martinez, and they all made contributions. And I'm very proud of that because it really helped set an example, I think, for young people in the district to look up to these folks to say, yes, si se puede, I can do this. Mm-hmm. And one day I can look to have the same ambition.
Well, something else that was going on there, were you part of the group of civic leaders that encouraged the revival of the Fiesta de las Rosas?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yes. So the Fiesta started in the 1920s, and it was a very big deal in San Jose. It faded out during the Depression, I guess.
Yes, it did.
And it was a celebration mainly of the Spanish heritage of California and San Jose. It was revived in 69, and it ended in tears.
It ended, yes.
From tear gas, I think.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
What happened?
Well, Mary Jane Sauerwein was the person who led the effort to bring back the Fiesta. It really was, in its day, a rival to the Rose Bowl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a group of us felt that, really, we ought to bring it back to San Jose because it was important in the early history of our city, and we needed to really have a celebration that could speak to the heritage of the city and to its growth. So we put together a committee and proceeded to planned the parade. Lorne Green was our grand marshal.
From Bonanza, yeah.
And we had a parade, but we also had a number of Latino activists that protested. And unfortunately, the protest got out of hand. As I've reflected on it, and I have quite a lot since that time, I think we made a mistake. Had we involved some of the Latino leadership, we had some Latino people on our committee, but apparently not the ones that were satisfactory.
Well, that was a big time of the rise of Latino,
exactly.
The Chicano movement in San Jose, farm workers movement, so it was very rapidly changing time.
And it was a mistake on our part. I think had we done that, and they felt ownership, we may still have that parade today.
Yeah.
but we didn't.
And it could be a big source of civic pride.
Oh, absolutely.
Didn't work out that time.
And it was a mistake.
Yeah.
And it was unfortunate. Because it's an awful lot of work, I can tell you that.
But I think it was an awakening for the city, for the Latino and Chicano population, as they asserted themselves, and for the city in general to recognize this is a real force.
And you know, the interesting part of all of that, Terry, is that subsequent to that time, I always had very good relationships with those leaders. I can remember, quite honestly, working with Cesar when Cesar Chavez, he was young, starting out here, active. I was also very active in the old San Jose Community Foundation, which was the forerunner of starting MOXA, for example.
Yeah.
That was one of our projects. We got them started. And so even in spite of the fact that we weren't able to carry on the parade and it didn't end on a very happy note, for at least personally for me, it resulted, I think, in some stronger relationships rather than weaker ones.
We'll hear more from Frank Fiscalini next month. Meanwhile, you can watch all of our shows on the Create TV YouTube page. Just go to YouTube and search for Create TV San Jose. You can also visit our website at createtvsj.org or email your comments to us at valleypolitics@createtvsj.org. And you can follow us on Facebook, where you can post comments and suggest guests or topics. And now, that's all, folks. Thanks for watching Valley Politics today. See you next time.
Do you care what's happening in your community? We do, which is why Create TV makes it a priority to bring you shows like Valley Politics. But we need your help. Create TV relies on tax-deductible donations from viewers like you to provide our community with informative local programming. If you like what you're watching, go to createtvsj.org and make a one-time donation, or become an ongoing supporter through our Friends of Create TV. Thanks for watching.